Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Jim, have you read any new books lately?
Yeah, let's see. I just finished one. It was called 1001 New Jumbles, Word Searches, and Brain Teasers. Okay, it's Wednesday.
It's Wednesday, right? Midweek.
Midweek. Yep. Mm-hmm. We're talking about books.
Yep.
These are not books we're talking about. These are the Rolling Stone books that we talked about yesterday.
But they are books.
Yes. You have many books. You read many books.
I have many books.
All right. Yeah. So this is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I am Patrick Foster.
And we do a thing. It's called Book Nook.
Yeah.
It's usually based on your reading because I just haven't had much time to read lately. Yeah. I have to figure out. I used to be a pretty avid reader, but it was like I had like certain time in my day that always sort of worked for me.
Yeah.
And my schedule with new job and things got all mixed up. And I still haven't found that moment. I got to figure out where's the time I carve in because I have so many books I need to get to. But in the meantime, you can tell me about books that you've read.
Tell you about books, Jim. I have actually brought my Kindle. I read on this. Somebody gave me one of these recently.
Nice.
Yeah, it's nice.
You're a part of the modern world.
It's the new fancy one. You can look up words and you can highlight things and get definitions. So it broadens your vocab, but it also allows you to take notes, highlight things, and take your own notes, which I do sometimes. But I want to talk briefly about a couple of books today. The first one is a long book. I don't know how many pages this thing is, but look here. That's chapter 62 right there, and that's somewhere in the middle of this book, so you know it's a long book. In the book itself, let me give you the official title.
Okay.
Meet Me in the Bathroom.
All right.
Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. So it covers a 10-year period in New York City rock and roll.
Right.
Lizzie Goodman is the author. Fascinating, interesting book, Jim, especially if you have any interest in this sort of period of time. Now, I want to engage you on this point, but before I do, I'll talk a little bit about the chief characters in the book and overall what I thought of the book. But I do want to engage you on the fact that this book is an oral history. Okay, so there's no real writing. It's just quotes from people telling the story woven together through this 10-year period and a little bit before. It starts a little bit before, but let me give you some of the main characters here that we talked about in the book.
Because what we're talking about here is early 2000s,
yep,
or the first decade of the 2000s, New York City. So who would be, for the listener here, who would be the bands that you're going to learn about in this book?
Yeah, so some of the main characters in the book are, so without a doubt, the Strokes probably are the chief character in this book. There's a lot in this book about James Murphy and DFA, his production sort of duo with Tim Goldsworthy. You get into a little bit into LCD Sound System. The Yeah Yeah Yeahs are a very big band in this book. Karen O is a central character. Vampire Weekend, TV on the Radio. Jack White is frequently mentioned in the book, which I thought was kind of interesting. There's a little bit of a relationship between the Strokes and the White Stripes, and they're both kind of coming up at the same time.
Right.
And I think, you know, the media sort of painted them together a little bit. You hear a little bit about the Walkmen. Interpol is another band
that's
mentioned very strongly. And running throughout all of this, you've got, you know, 9/11 happened early on in this book, but it's also the period where Napster and the internet and MP3 blogs really started to come in.
Right.
And make a big difference. And Ryan Adams floats in and out through this book. So it's a very wide-ranging cast of characters. It does tell the story of the rise of the Strokes in a very interesting way. Last night, she said, oh, baby, I feel so down. Oh, it turned me off when I feel left out. So I turn around. Oh, baby, I don't care no more. I know this for sure. I'm walking out that door. You know, they were privileged kids. They were kind of rich kids, and they came up and sort of, you know, had this band. I don't know how you feel about the Strokes, but I remember when that first album came out, and everybody was kind of talking about, you know, is this it? This is it, right? And you know, the AAS too, and TV on the Radio and all those bands, and sort of the divide between Manhattan and Brooklyn, all these things are touched on. It's a really fascinating book. It's you know, it's highly enjoyable. You hear all kinds of crazy stories about drugs and the weird, you know, awful stuff that people did, and the Strokes slid pretty far off the rails, off those druggy rails, at least two of the main guys did. I've got some frustrations with it too, though, because the form, the oral history, and the two other ones I can think of are Please Kill Me,
right,
which was the New York kind of, you know, scene, CBGB, and the sort of the rise of punk in New York,
right, the punk scene,
yeah. And then there's one called
by Legs McNeil, which is considered a classic.
It is, right? Yeah, of the form, probably the first one I ever read that was, yeah, like that. And there's another one called We Got the Neutron Bomb that sort of covers the LA scene,
right.
For me, the problem always is context. Like, you lose some of the history, you know, when you're dealing with an oral history book like this. So I'd like to get your thoughts on the form.
Well, and the other oral history that I read a few years ago was, there was one about the Replacements.
Oh, right. Yeah. I think I might have read that too.
Jim Walsh, I think, was
something like that.
The author.
Mm-hmm.
He was somebody who was like, I kind of like Legs McNeil and Lizzie Goodman, he was somebody who was like part of that scene at the time, ran with these guys,
yeah,
and all that. I want to make sure I have his name correct. I'll look that up as I'm talking. But then when I realized sort of the shortcomings of the oral history form was when I read Bob Mayer's book on the Replacements, and that was just so much better.
Yeah,
you know,
it really told
like
a complete story. And
that's
really
right.
Filled the characters out. Yeah. And so that, I think, you know, is a really good point. Like, now, for example, if you didn't know a lot about Ryan Adams and you read this book, you just sort of get the impression that Ryan Adams was like sort of the biggest a-hole in the room all the time, and, you know, was a loudmouth and just was kind of a drug fiend, and, you know, went around just doing stuff, where that's not the complete picture of the guy, right? And you get sort of a one-sided view sometimes of people. And I think, you know, Tim Goldsworthy, although he defends himself, you know, really gets shafted in this book. And people are pretty honest about James Murphy, too, and what a control freak he is and a workaholic, and you sort of get all that stuff. So you get a lot of good stories, but also you get stuff that sort of comes out of context and you don't really understand, you know, because these people are talking with their whole life history behind them, and they're just sort of talking to Lizzie Goodman. So
it's sort of the difference between, if you ever watch, I watch a lot of rock documentaries.
Yeah.
Right. And some of them are just kind of like talking head kind of stuff, where it's just, you know, interview, maybe there's a music clip in here,
yeah,
that kind of thing. And then others will try to give you more context of like the culture at the time and what was going on and sort of how this fit in and how people reacted and all that. And to me, that's kind of the difference here too, with this sort of oral history,
mm-hmm,
where you're getting some really good insight into those particular people and their thoughts and feelings and them sort of recounting it, but you're not really getting a great sense of how it necessarily fit in or,
yeah,
what its true, you know, impact was.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly right. Yeah. And, there's one quote here that I want to read just really quickly from this guy, Andy Greenwald. And it sort of sums up a little bit of,
he's great,
of how this went.
He's a writer.
Yeah. Right? He's a, yeah, writer. Mm-hmm. He says, "One thing about the 2000s is that everything happened too fast. The time that passed between Nirvana and Candlebox was probably 2 or 3 years. The time between the Strokes and Long Wave was like 18 months. There were diminishing returns. The Strokes weren't really that big. Everyone needed them to be that big and desperately wanted them to be big, but they kind of weren't. And yet when you read this book, the Strokes are kind of everything, you know, when they blow up. And they were a huge influential band in New York City. I mean, they inspired tons and tons of other bands, and they were kind of the return to rock and roll for a lot of people in the early 2000s.
It's funny. I've seen the Strokes. I saw them play,
yeah,
once.
Yeah, me too. I've seen them play a couple times.
This would have been in like the mid-2000s.
Okay.
I want to say it must have been their second album,
okay,
which is really good.
Room on Fire.
Yep, yep, mm-hmm, it was that.
Definitely gets shafted, you know, in comparison to that.
It's a really good record.
Yeah.
I think their first two are really, really,
yeah,
strong.
The second one might even be better than the first one.
Albums.
Yeah.
I think there's a real spirit about those records. So for me, it was kind of exciting. Somebody was, you know, that there was a new sort of big,
yeah,
band emerging, right?
Yeah. A rock band.
Right,
yeah,
exactly. Even though already in my mind, I sort of felt like it's not necessarily aimed at me. Like,
yeah,
this was, the Strokes might have been kind of like that feeling where page had kind of turned, right? You know, because if rock music was traditionally sort of always marketed at, you know, a teenager, then you sort of felt like when you're in your 30s, is this for me? Should I be buying this? Should I be listening to this? Whatever. Again, you sort of, you felt like a little bit of an outsider, right? Mm-hmm. To that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was really exciting. I thought they were a great band. The thing about the Strokes, though, was that it just seemed to all fall apart
really
fast, mm-hmm. didn't it? And maybe that was the drugs. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. I will make it clear, and I think Lizzie Goodman has said this in a couple of interviews. This is not a biography of the Strokes, although it comes pretty darn close.
Okay.
You know, as deep as you get into the band. But yeah, the drugs, they kind of skidded off the rails. They probably tried to bite off a little more than they could chew with a major label. They were dealing with major label problems, producer problems, and Strokes really were a handoff from one era to the, you know, another one. And they sort of got the last, you know, of that Nirvana major label vacuuming up all the bands that were available. But the parallel between Vampire Weekend and the Strokes in this book is fascinating, because Vampire Weekend were presented with some of the same choices that the Strokes had, but they made them completely differently, right? They could have signed to a major label, but they didn't. They didn't think they needed to, because they had, you know, the internet, and they stayed small and grew really slowly, where the Strokes, you know, tried to just drink it all and snort it all up in one big, big mess. So fascinating book and well worth your time, but it's a long one, but very much worth reading.
Yeah. I'm very interested in that. I want to read that. And again, it sort of takes you into a world that hasn't really been reported yet. Right. So this is kind of like the first draft of history,
really,
right?
It really is. Yeah. And the only other thing I'll say about the Strokes is that in this book, pretty much all parties agree that they were the ones who brought skinny jeans into being. So if you're wearing the skinny jeans now, may be because of the Strokes.
I like that. Yeah. All right. Okay. So we'll take a quick little break here, and then we're going to talk about another book.
Yeah. I got another book that I briefly want to touch on that I read that I think everybody will find interesting.
All right. I've been working on a piece that speaks of sex and desperation. I've been screwing on the tracks of abandoned train stations. All right, so speaking of live music scenes,
yes,
we're
going to
host our own little live music
mm-hmm.
event on October 21st.
Isn't that going to be fun?
It's going to be a lot of fun. We have a really great musician. Her name is Lisa Saeed. She's mm-hmm. going to play some songs for the podcast. You'll be able to hear those on the podcast. We're going to interview her and talk about music with her. And in addition to that, if you want to come out and see it live, if you're in the D.C. area, we're going to be at Black Walnut Brewery. I mean, come on. Where else are we going to have an event?
Exactly right.
At a brewery.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Leesburg, Virginia. We hope to see you there. And it'll get started around noon. So it's early. Get your drinking in early that day.
I'm excited about that.
There's still time to do whatever, you know, you got going on that night. And it's going to be a lot of fun, right?
It's going to be a lot of fun. She's going to play a couple songs for us. We'll interview her. And I can't wait.
Yeah. I think everybody's really going to enjoy that.
Yep.
So come out to Black Walnut Brewery. Come around noon on October 21st. Okay, we're back. We're talking books. Let's get to book number two.
Book number two. Yeah, I'm gonna just really briefly touch on this book. So this book, it was published in 2009. I just found it.
Okay.
It's called You Never Give Me Your Money, subtitled The Beatles After the Breakup. It's written by Peter Doggett. It's really a fascinating book, Jim. It sort of begins in 1970 when the Beatles were pretty much on the skids and had broken up, and goes all the way through basically the assassination of John Lennon, kind of ends the book. So it's about that 10-year period. Jim, I got to tell you, I've read a lot of books about the Beatles, read a lot of stuff about the Beatles, but I've never read a book like this. And this book really focuses on how much trouble the Beatles made for themselves kind of by being the Beatles. Gosh, man, they must have sued each other and, you know, various lawyers and corporations, who knows how many times, countless times. I mean, they spent so much time, you know, going through lawsuits and dealing with lawyers and hiring and firing. Alan Klein is a, you know, a central player who kind of came in and separated, you know, John basically from Paul, and George, you know, was trying to become his own person at that time. And Ringo was just kind of out there floating around on kind of slowly becoming an alcoholic and a drug addict and trying to deal with all this. But the Apple Corporation that they founded turned out to be a massive financial headache and loss for them. And so in some ways, this book is really sad because you sort of read about all the, you know, the trouble that these guys had and how much money they lost, you know, through this Apple Corporation that they wanted to be like this utopian vision of how to do business, but turned out just to be the most gigantic mess of all time. And there was a lot of people, a lot of private school educations, it says at some point in this book, were paid for by the Beatles money because they paid so many lawyers and their publishing wasn't handled right. And they never really had a solid manager after Brian Epstein died. And just in many, you know, in many of the same ways that the Beatles invented the way we think about pop music and the way it was recorded, and they broke down so many barriers, they also set a precedent in how you handle your business affairs and how much they paid lawyers and how bad mistakes they made, you know, for record corporations. So in that sense, it's a really sad story, you know, and but it's also fascinating. If you're a fan of the Beatles, I think you owe it to yourself to kind of read this and just sort of just kind of get the, you know, the whole story.
So obviously there've been a lot of books written about the Beatles, but this is really just about sort of like the business of being the Beatles.
It really,
right?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. It really is.
And it's written in a way that sort of the layman can understand.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah. Okay. And I'll just read one little summary here, that kind of sums it up, and there isn't a whole lot I think, else we need to say, but, so this is quoting Peter Doggett's introduction. John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Richard Starkey are locked together for all time as guardians of popular music's most enduring legacy. But their bonds don't end there. Since 1967, they or their heirs have been co-owners of Apple Corp, a venture that was originally envisioned as a tax dodge and refashioned as a revolutionary alternative to the capitalist system. But it then corroded to become a magnet for lawyers and accountants. What was conceived as utopia turned out to be a prison. So that's kind of what the book is about.
Okay. And for anyone who doesn't understand this, this is not Apple, the iPod computer Apple, right?
No.
They didn't have to bring Steve Jobs back to save the company, right?
But you do learn a little bit later in the book. They sort of foreshadow when Apple computing was coming and how they dealt with that. But they had the name long before that.
That's right. So this also reminds me of one of the great Beatles quotes of all time.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Paul McCartney.
Uh-huh.
And he says, John and I literally used to sit down and say, now let's write a swimming pool.
Yeah.
So they knew, you know, during the career of the Beatles that they could just, that it wasn't too hard for them to make gobs and gobs of money.
Yeah.
Right.
And that was the point of it. You know, the Apple company was, they had to do something with all this money they had, or they would just get destroyed by taxes. And so they thought they'd put it into this company. And at one point, John Lennon was pretty broke.
Right. So, all right.
So yeah,
so that's good.
I would just say a refreshing different take on the Beatles and gives you a different side of rock and roll for sure.
All right, cool. All right, those are two good book recommendations.
Yeah,
get out there, read those. And let us know if there's any other books that we should check out, right?
I will.
I mean, the listeners can let us know,
too. They could do that, too. Yeah, I'd appreciate any recommendations, folks, because right now I'm out of books.
All right. Okay, so this is not reading material. This is listening material.
Yes.
Listen to Rock in the Suburbs.
Every day.
We assume that you have time in your schedule.
Yeah, to do so.
You know, marked off for that. You can find the show at, speaking of Apple Podcasts,
yes,
or Audio Boom or other podcast platforms. You can also find us at suburbspod.com, mm-hmm, where there is some stuff you can read there. in addition to listening to the show.
Yep.
You can also email us your book recommendations, rock@suburbspod.com, or call and talk to us about a great book you've read recently. Or if you read either of these two, what's your impression of those? You can call our suburban party line,
612-440-1984.
And then also find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Suburbs Pod. This is Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we, as you mentioned, we're on every day, so we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Sniffs, man.